the American power elite is either antagonistic to Islam per se, or Muslims per se,
or afraid of it.
I believe that the average American is actually fairly unconcerned with the differences of his neighbors. I will tell you this: I live up in Washington Heights. There's a Yemeni newsstand on the corner that, you know, Nissan candies, soda, so forth and so on, and Lotto, of course.
Yeah.
It's entirely staffed by young.
Okay, you got 30. You got 30. We got to go in a minute.
And they are treated with utter respect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. What's your name?
Stefan.
Stefan, say hello if you see me.
Pardon?
Say hello if you see me.
I shall.
Thank you for contributing tonight.
And I dreamed I was dying. I dreamed that my soul rose unexpectedly, and looking back down at me, smiled reassuringly. And I dreamed I was flying.
And that's what we've been doing tonight. This has been Earthwatch on WBAI New York, streaming at WBAI.org and broadcasting at 99.5 FM. I've been Robert Knight, looking forward to more communications from your brilliances at rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. And join us Thursday at 8 o'clock at Connolly's, 121 West 45th Street, with Greg Palast, Dan Vitelli, Angela Scott, Scott Blakeman, John McDonough, and, of course, the inimitable, but imitating of all great voices, Randy Credico. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
Oh, and it's all right. It's all right, it's all right. You can't be forever blessed. Still, tomorrow's gonna be another working day, and I'm trying to get some rest. That's all I'm trying, to get some rest.
WBAI, New York. Pardon us while our computer figures out how to howl.
Good morning.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, that Paul Simon song is the perfect segue because we'll be discussing The Rapture. That is to say, The Rapture of the Nerds by Cory Doctorow and Charles Stross in a one-hour conversation recorded last week. Stay tuned. I'm going to make one basic announcement, and then let's get right to the meat of the show. The announcement is this coming Wednesday, that would be 6 days from now, at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, will be Paul Tremblay, the author of Swallowing a Donkey's Eye, a dystopian dark fantasy, with people in chicken and duck suits from Chizine Publications. Chizine, this is me going off script, is really putting out some very cool stuff. And Amakatsu, with whose work I'm not familiar, which is exciting. And she is the author of The Taker and The Reckoning, the first two novels in a supernatural trilogy of love, obsession, and redemption. So that's next Wednesday, September 19th, 7 p.m. at the KGB Bar, 85 East 4th Street, just off 2nd Avenue. Admission is free. Okay. The following week, on the 27th, there are two readings. There is the Kindred reading series, which is put together by Jen Brissett and Kay Tempest Bradford, who attentive listeners to this show have heard before, will be one of the two readers. And I'm so sorry, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I'll be repeating this next week in detail, will be the other. Then opposite that, unavoidably opposite that, and besides, I'll say I booked it first, because ours was set 3 months ago, but there's nothing that can be done about it at this late date. Deborah Grabian and Roz Cavaney will be our guests, one from London, one from San Francisco, and the host will be the wonderful Professor Veronica Shanus, and she really is something else. I was once explaining Hour of the Wolf. She said, you know, where does the name come from? I started telling her, and she said, oh, you mean the Varg Teaman. And it's like, oh my God, I'd never met anybody who actually had knowledge of what Hour of the Wolf was about outside of the Ingmar Bergman movie, or perhaps, unfortunately, the Babylon 5 episode of the same name. Anyway, that is neither here nor there, because we have a very exciting show for you tonight. Last Thursday in town were Cory Doctorow and Charlie Stross, who are promoting their collaborative novel. Actually, it's three novellas that together make a novel, The Rapture of the Nerds. And to find out exactly what that means, Just stay tuned. You will learn more. But we go right into it. And with these guys are talkers. And please don't worry. There's in the beginning a lot of technical information about the singularity and things like that. We get past that. We're talking about a great deal of things. Charlie is really one of the best proponents of hard science fiction today, you know, meaning stuff actually based on scientific background. And he has dealt with what is referred to as the singularity a great deal. He's a wonderful writer of many, many short stories. And by the way, he also, aside from writing various novels, is a fabulous short story writer. Cory Doctorow, the other guy, and you will know when Charlie Strauss is talking by the Scottish accent. Okay. Cory Doctorow lives in London, but is actually from Ontario and moved to London some years back. Probably his best known novel is Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. He has what is probably the most read non-political blog, period, bar none, maybe even including political blogs. I'm not sure. It's called Boing Boing. At some point, you may have heard of it. You may have read part of it. But this is something that he created, and it is viral. When I put out the tweet earlier tonight saying that the show would be on, he retweeted, and I thought, oh, that's cool. I've got probably about, I think, 400 or 500 followers, right? And I took a look and thought, you know, I bet Corey's got a few more. Yeah. He's got approximately 487,000 followers every time he sends out a tweet. That's how many people can potentially read it. He was a major proponent politically, a major proponent of the Electric Frontier Foundation. At one point, he was sort of the European spokesman for the EFF. He is a proponent of Creative Commons, which is an alternative to copyright. All of this is going to come up in the... I'm sorry, I'm just reading a piece in the bio and questioning a little thing that I saw here. Digital rights management, various things, what he calls post-scarcity economics. And it says here, and this is what was raising my eyes, he was one of the few internet journalists to correctly predict the failure of the New York Times metered paywall. Well, I'm not sure how accurate that is. This is Wikipedia, after all, because as far as I know, the metered paywall of the New York Times has been very successful. They are actually turning a profit from it. So I'm not sure how people can refer to it as a failure. Anyway, that's all aside. We will have time. The interview runs 55 minutes. So, this was very thrilling because this was at Tor Books. We didn't have time to come to WBAI and record this. We would have lost like half an hour when they were between one moment and another. And the one moment and another that I was between before they saw me, the previous night, I think they were in Kentucky. Then they traveled all night. They got to New York and they went to Google, where they were filmed and interviewed and stuff. I assume it's on YouTube, but I haven't seen it. So they spent the morning and through lunch at Google, which is a very cool place. And then they went to their publicist's office at Tor Books in the Flatiron Building, which is a lot of fun. And that is where we recorded. And when we were done, they were with the New York Times. Then they did, then they had to go to Forbidden Planet to sign books. Then they had to go to Brooklyn to a place that just sells bots of various kinds. And then they were off to Maine. As far as I know, they've actually come back to New York. I mean, this is just a whirlwind tour. And it was very cool to be able to get them. Corey's done this show twice before, each time recorded. He's never actually been here in order to take live phone calls. One of these days we'll fix that. Charlie Strauss, this was the first time I had met up with him 2 years ago at ReaderCon, but never actually last year at ReaderCon, but never with enough time to conduct an interview. So it was very cool to be able to do that. It's a fun conversation, and I hope you enjoy it, he said, going over. Let's see if this time the PC is going to hesitate before it plays anything, or if it just goes in. That's hesitating, just as I predicted. Come on. Here we go. Wrong thing, you see? Where was that howl when I wanted it? Okay.
We should slate it. What's today's date? It's like September 5th?
September 6th.
There we go.
September 6th. Thank you very much. And we're in the offices of Tor. And they are Cory Doctorow and Charles Strauss. People who, if I had my preference, each one would have their own three-hour slot, and then we'd do another one together. But I'll take it as it comes, because there's a new book out, The Rapture of the Nerds. And what can one say with a title like that? It's just so long as it's not a bad movie, because they did Triumph of the Nerds and
Revenge of the Nerds.
Revenge of the Nerds. So there were like two or three.
Actually, the title comes from a comment by Ken MacLeod, another science fiction writer, who Corey has been introducing as a former Trotskyite. I should add, he grew up as the son of a lay preacher in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. So he sort of moved from one doctrinaire position to another. You know, he threw off a fundamentalist Christianity, went to university, and came down with the first mimetic virus going.
Oh my God.
Which he subsequently got over. He came up with a saying that the singularity is just the rapture of the nerds. The alternative coinage would be that the rapture is the singularity of the fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea is that in the sort of classic popular culture version of the singularity, you've got the left behinds, where all of the people who are good and pious and not very technical and you know, firm dualists who believe in a separate soul and physical being, those people all disappear from the earth, leaving only behind sort of the secular, the skeptical, the technical. And in the singularity, you have everybody who is skeptical and technical disappearing, having their brains disassembled and turned into component atoms and sent into some sort of computational cloud. And everybody left behind is, you know, a dualist, a Luddite, a skeptic of technology.
Excellent. Well, so I know which direction I'm going in, and listeners should be warned in which direction. Literarily speaking, where did the singularity begin?
Oh, well, I think Charlie's the one with the longest origin for that. I mean, the obvious answer is, you know, Werner Vinge's coinage, but which we can get into in a minute, but I think Charlie should talk about Mr. Fedorov.
Yeah, I think we should actually bear in mind that it should be traced back as a direct lineal descendant in modified form of the cultural meme that gave rise to the Revelation of St. John. It really is that old. Let's trace it backwards. We're used to the modern singularitarians, to the likes of Raymond Kurzweil, suggesting mind uploading, ubiquitous computing, magic fluffy nanites everywhere, it's all going to be wonderful. But the idea actually goes back further. Werner Vinge actually coined the term singularity in the science fiction context in the 1990s, early 1990s, late 80s, but he actually meant something rather different by it. His was a very narrow definition of an inflection point at which progress in computing technology means that we human beings will no longer be in the driving seat of change affecting us. His take on it was, if we can develop artificial intelligences that are equivalent to human beings, then by throwing more computing resources at them, we can make them run faster. And if we make them run faster, if it's possible to come up with stronger algorithms for thinking, ones that are as fundamentally smarter than we are as we are than a frog, then it will be these human equivalent AIs that do it. And once that arrives, we're not going to be controlling the shape of the world we live in anymore. How this sort of got mangled and conflated with the mind-uploading utopian rapture of a nerd stuff is a very interesting question, but one that I think can only be answered by sociology. Now, go back to the 1990s, and indeed to the 1980s, and a lot of the stuff that Kurzweil is pushing today was being talked about on the Extropians discussion list on the early internet then, and they in turn were prefigured by equivalent discussions in print media in the 1920s. The particular forum to refer to is the Russian Cosmist movement. The Cosmists were, I guess, post-Russian revolutionary techno-utopians who believed that once we achieve true communism, we will be able to develop immortality, colonize the universe, resurrect the dead, resurrect everybody who's ever potentially lived. They weren't thinking small. And you know, we can trace their lineage back even further to a guy called Nikolai Fedorov, who was a Russian Orthodox theologian. Fedorov is an interesting guy. He's relatively unknown in the West, but he was a teacher, among other things, of Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, the father of rocketry, the guy who invented the rocket equation and popularized rocketry in Russia. And he was a Russian Orthodox theologian who was trying to come up with a teleological argument for what God put us on Earth to do. And the first thing was, it was fairly obvious, you know, God intended us to achieve heaven on Earth through our own efforts, having given us the tools. This was sort of take the Scottish Enlightenment programme of progress towards perfection and amp it up to the nth degree. Fedorov believed that war was sinful, that conflict was sinful, that what was needed was a grand program that would unite all humanity behind one cause. And the obvious cause to Fedorov was achieving immortality and colonizing the entire universe. He wanted first to defeat the processes that result in death through advanced medicine, then to get into space, expand into the universe, give human beings in space solar wings and the ability to photosynthesize, rendering us independent of food and post-scarcity,
Keeping in mind this is in the 19th century.
Yep. And then, he considered it to be a logical affront that if humanity was sort of immortal and had inherited the universe, that other humans should still be mouldering in the grave. Therefore, the final project for humanity, after achieving immortality and colonizing the universe, must be to not resurrect not only all their dead ancestors, but all the other possible human beings who might have existed in timelines leading up to the datum. And this was sort of 19th century Russian theologically informed futurism. And if you drop this agenda today into the Extropians mailing list without telling them who it came from, nobody would bat an eyelid.
Oh, God. When did the Extropians mailing list start?
Late 1980s.
Okay, yeah.
Furthermore, in California...
Late, so I was
they're
on
mostly
PBS's by then. So were you.
They're mostly libertarians, and I think they'd be somewhat astonished to discover that one of their enthusiastic fellow travellers from 60 years ago were all enthusiastic Leninists. But it goes back further. You go to the Scottish Enlightenment of the 18th century and you get the idea of the improvability of humanity. You can take it back all the way. Around the year 1000, there were these sort of random tribes and movements of peasants all over Europe throwing over their farms, forming free love communes and wandering all over landscape, enjoying themselves, or looting and pillaging, as was their inclination, because they knew Jesus was going to come back in the next
year. That's when a rave was still a rave.
Oh, yeah. And fundamentally, this all goes back to apocalyptic imagery and eschatology in Judaism after the fall of the Second Temple in 70 CE, I would say. I'm not aware of much tendency in this direction before then, but the apocalypse of St. John the Revelation of St. John, the Book of the Apocalypse, was very much in keeping with other Jewish mystical ranting and propaganda of its day.
So I like to think of this as being a kind of progressive apocalypse. So it's pretty easy to see kind of where the apocalypse might have arrived from, because you start with people with this notion of lapsarianism, where we've all been kicked out of the garden and things are just going to get worse from here on in. There's even super Orthodox Jewish traditions where rabbis aren't allowed to supersede any rabbi that came before them, because by definition a rabbi from the past was closer to the garden and hence to the mind of God than a contemporary rabbi. So new rabbis never know as much as old rabbis. And, you know, it's pretty easy to see where the idea that things are just going to get worse from here on in come from, because as you get older, it's pretty clear that the world is getting worse. After all, everything used to taste better and smell better and look better, and the people of your preferred gender were a lot prettier. And certainly you didn't hurt quite so much, and your vision was more acute, and so on.
Oh, and children are being disrespectful to their elders, which now include you.
Yes, absolutely. Something that Socrates once complained about. And so this idea that things are only going to get worse, it's pretty easy to see where it arrives from. And I think as human beings, we're not comfortable with unbounded systems. We tend to think of, when we're asked to consider something getting worse forever, I think we arrive at a point where we can't imagine them getting any worse. And that's the singularity. That's the apocalypse. That's the moment at which everything just falls to pieces. You know, the center cannot hold, the tipping point for worseness. And I think starting with the Enlightenment and the idea that things are only going to get better, you have a similar dynamic at work. If things are only going to get better from here on in, whether that's, you know, steam engines becoming more efficient or Moore's law and die sizes decreasing and computing power increasing exponentially over time, there comes a point where we say, well, at a certain point, things will be so good that we'll break with history. The bubble, you know, the balloon will pop and things will not be able to get any more better. And I think that's one of the things at work when we talk about singularity, is this idea that the human brain is uncomfortable with unbounded conditions.
So, I mean, this is something that everybody listening, especially the cab drivers, already know. This is like the
The
simple stuff.
Yeah.
You have both collaborated on singularity stories before, have you not?
Well, this novel is the outgrowth of those stories. So we wrote a novella together about 7 years ago called
Jury Service,
and then we wrote a sequel called Appeals Court, and then Tor solicited a book from us made up of those two novellas, rewritten with a third one added to it called Parole Board. So Rapture of the Nerds fixes up those three novellas into a single, more or less coherent narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a wonderful read.
Thank you.
I remember the first story from way back when. Where was that published?
It was published on sci-fi.com.
Okay, because right. I knew it was online. So it was Dadlow.
Yes.
Yes.
She commissioned it.
Yes. Yes. And then, she has so much to answer for.
Then a year or two later, Lou Anders, who was editing Argosy at the time, commissioned a sequel and wanted to bind them together as a chapbook with Argosy issue number 3. And Argosy vanished after issue 3, but we got the chapbook out.
Which is why I didn't happen to see that one. He's at Pyre now, right?
Pyre? I don't know how to pronounce it.
I think they say Pyre.
They say Pyre.
Yeah.
They're lacking an E if they want to be Pyre. They should be
P-Y-R-E.
That it's a well-understood spelling and pronunciation.
Yeah, but they're a good imprint.
They are an amazing imprint. They just yesterday published the new Ian McDonald young adult novel, the sequel to Planesrunner, Be My Enemy, which is one of the best YA books I've read this year. It's a terrific book.
Yeah. Now, for all of this talk, and for all the singularity stuff, and all the depth that is actually in these works, it's also, on the surface, a good read, a fun read. This is something that I think we need to point out to people.
It's pretty gonzo.
On the one hand, I love getting into the depth of the talk that we are doing here, over my head or not.
Right.
By the same token, this isn't a podcast, this is a broadcast. So when I say cab drivers and whatever, I'm serious and I want to tell people, don't be afraid. It's just a good read, no matter what.
It's meant to be a book of comic weirdness. So it started with Charlie sending me a chunk of a story that he'd been working on that was about as comic and weird as anything I'd read, and then me trying to top it, and then him trying to top what I sent him, and back and forth.
We basically played tennis with the manuscript, trying to get the other guy to drop the ball.
Right.
And we did it in sort of 2 to 4 page chunks, you know, write your way out of this, you bastard.
Volleys. Yeah, yeah it was, and so it is...
A time-honored tradition.
Among the weirdest, funniest things that I've read, I think, and I say that because it's not just mine, it's Charlie's too.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly, it has the hallmark of a successful collaboration from the collaborator's perspective in that there are bits that I think, I probably wrote those, and bits where I think, oh, I think Charlie wrote those.
And then bits where we can't tell.
Really big bits where I'm like, who the hell wrote that?
Okay, yeah, how did that get in there?
Yeah.
It was a singularity.
Yeah, clearly. Mm. Well, it's transcendence more. You know, we actually managed to transcend our individual writing styles and come up with a third synthetic author.
Oh my god.
That is Strostero.
Strostero. Mm. That works for me. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Oh, so, Dr. Ross.
Dr. Ross.
Dr. Ross. Yeah, they both work. They both have a certain...
Frankensteinian nature.
Yeah. Yes. And a good flow.
That's Frankenstein.
Anyway, I've been up all night, excuse me.
I understand. But, so have we for a couple of days running now.
Yeah, and jumping from one town to another.
That's
like
right.
Nobody's business.
Like fat on a grill.
What technique do you use for collaboration? I mean, you are both ultra sophisticated in... Well, internet technologies.
We could have used some kind of exotic joint editing software mediated via the internet, but you know, when you're working on something this big, you don't want to risk it to some piece of technology. You'd much rather keep it simple. So what we did was we basically used Markdown, a very simple formatting of plain text files that can then be turned into a Word document later, and sent them back and forth as attachments to email messages. Corey kept his stored using Git, a version control system. I wasn't so obsessive about keeping them, but I've still got archived mail inboxes, and I had regular backups on the Mac using Time Machine every 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So we both have snapshots of what it looked like along the way.
Yeah. Go ahead.
We just kept the protocol for exchanging files as simple and bulletproof as possible.
My friend Thomas Gideon wrote a piece of software for me that's free and open called Flashbake. You can download it for free from GitHub.
Flashbake.
And every 15 minutes, Flashbake takes all my working files and takes whatever new has been added to them and saves them as a what's called a diff, so the differential, to a database.
That's old Unix stuff.
That's right. Yeah. It's old version control stuff, but it notes at the time where I am, so it figures out my location from my computer's IP address. What the weather is there, what the last 3 songs I listened to were, and what the last 3 headlines I posted to Boing Boing were.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a kind of long-term deep record of what goes on in my life when I'm creating. And I figure, you know, in 10 or 15 years, I release that data set and say, all right, world, explain to me how my creative process works, you know, and see what happens.
Yeah, I'm just amazed. I mean, on the one hand, yes, we're going beyond the geek and using all of this incredible stuff. And yet I'm sort of shocked to find out that you didn't use collaborative software.
Well, that means that you have to be online, right? Most of that collaborative ware wants you to be online. And both of us do a lot of writing in those interstitial moments when there's no internet access.
Yeah,
or if your internet connection at home goes down while you're plugged into it and you're trying to save something to make matters worse.
Yeah.
Lots of beard chewing goes on there.
The classic acronym,
Keep It Simple, Stupid, applies.
Yeah. Kiss. Yeah.
I think that old school technical people, the longer you work with technology, the more attuned you become to how systems fail and not how they work.
Mm-hmm.
How systems work, it's kind of interesting. I like things that are convenient and work well. But I would any day take a system that's a little clunky when it's working, but fails very gracefully, over a system that works beautifully but fails disastrously.
Yep. Similarly, I like old-time Unixy command line environments or Linux-based ones because I'm an old-time Unix gearhead for more than 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning an actual programmer. I've been a Linux user, but I cannot even man a page.
I don't want to do this as boasting, but one of my servers has an uptime but past 630 days a couple of days ago.
Wow.
It's going to be taken down and replaced with a new box running a new OS release, but I like reliability like that, mm-hmm. Especially when I'm entrusting major pieces of work to it.
Yeah. I'm mentioning, by the way, we have here a couple of PDAs, and I've also brought with me, talking about analog, a PAV.
Right.
Which, for those watching on the radio, it's a pad.
Right.
With a pen. But
actually, the interesting thing is the hybrids. I don't know if you've seen the announcement that came out last week about a collaboration between Evernote and Moleskine.
Mm-hmm.
No. Moleskine are going to begin selling a new type of notebook in the next month or so with registration dots on the pages. And Evernote have just modified their software so that if you photograph one of these pages from one of these notebooks,
it automatically squares it up.
It deskews it, color balances it, then uploads it, and
nice.
Does handwriting recognition on anything you wrote there, then adds it to your Evernote account.
That's pretty
it's
sweet.
It's a hybrid of pencil and paper and the cloud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm working on a comparison between Evernote and SpringPad and all of those mm-hmm. right now. So, and I didn't even know that.
I just use a text editor for the most part. I mean, you know, if you think about it, programmers could use any tool they wanted to compose text all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it didn't exist, they could write it. And most programmers settle on something like a text editor. You know, if the people who have the widest
well,
access...
Well, especially programmers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If the people have the widest access to text manipulation tools settle on a tool, that's probably a good indicator. I mean, certainly my text editor doesn't crash.
I wrote about a dozen novels using Vim, a descendant of the Vi text editor on Unix, plus a custom tool chain and make files I rolled myself to export it to other formats. The only thing that finally forced me to abandon it was publishers, ironically, adapting an electronic workflow. They all standardized on Microsoft Word and Adobe Acrobat,
mm-hmm.
at which point couldn't stay in that world anymore.
What are, technologically speaking, you each have these incredible credentials on technology, both on what it is, Corey, you more on the social realizations of technology, mm-hmm. and you on the technical, the real thing, the hardcore.
Bit less on the hardcore these days. It's 10 years since I've had to program for a living. I'm succumbing to bit rot.
Yeah, well, I mean, I once wrote a thing in Fox Pro. That's my programming experience.
Okay.
So, you know, there are differences here, you know?
Well, I worked as a programmer, and then started a software company, too, so I've been involved with both aspects of it.
And the EFF.
Well, yes, that wasn't a technical job. I mean, that was a policy, purely policy job. We had
no, but it was about technology.
But it was about technology.
It was the emergence of technology.
And we had amazing staff technologists at Electronic Frontier Foundation, like Seth Schoen, who's still there, and is, you know, among other things, wrote the DCSS haiku. So when it became illegal to publish the code that let you decode DVDs, when a court ruled that the First Amendment didn't extend to the right to publish software to decode DVDs, he embedded all the instructions in a series of haiku, and he said, well, now it's poetry. Is it still illegal to publish it?
Mm-hmm.
It's quite good.
Yeah, that is good. It's an ongoing battle.
Mm-hmm.
It still is. I assume that both of you are hyper aware of what happened this weekend with the webcast of the Hugo Awards.
I was upstairs in the WorldCon in 2014 party, sort of live, repeating the live tweets for everybody else in the room, above it, right while it happened. Apparently, the following Monday, the word that went around was that the chief executive of Ustream had got in touch, being horribly embarrassed because he was an SF fan himself and had been trying to follow it.
Right. Well,
And we should just briefly tell people what happened was during a segment of the Hugo Awards where they were showing clips from...
Well, Neil Gaiman was accepting an award for a script that he'd written for Doctor Who, and they had cleared a segment from the BBC to show of his award-winning
script. And they cleared it for internet as well.
And they cleared it for all uses.
Ah.
And they not to mention that it's fair use to air it.
But yes, it is.
It was cleared as well. And they even so, Ustream had basically been using some third-party... copyright enforcement bot that had... a database of copyrighted works, and if it ever found one of these copyrighted works in a Ustream, it would just shut it down.
It had no whitelist.
Well, it had no judgment.
It's early days.
And it's not early days. It's, in fact, a fool's errand, right? There is no software bot that can watch the internet and make a determination about whether a particular use is lawful or not, Because the way that fair use works in this country is that a judge weighs four or more subjective factors and makes a fact-intensive finding, right? Until you can upload the consciousness of your local federal circuit en banc and have them make determinations in real time, there is no such thing as a software bot that can do it. The closest approximation we have...
You just came up with a plot of a short story.
Well, there you go.
But yeah, can I elaborate on it?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but the closest approximation we have is a piece of software that pretends that the public has no right to use copyrighted works and assumes that all uses are infringing. In other words, something that confiscates all rights from the public. And I think to say that it's early days is wrong. I think that... what it is depraved indifference to the public's rights and copyright.
Yeah, I think it's early days for the public. I think it's late days or mid for you, mm-hmm. because you've been doing this at least since the 80s. And actually, as a user, so have I. I was on BBS's 1981, 82, but I'm a user.
Right.
You are creators. I am a producer and mm-hmm. distributor. Mm-hmm. So it is early days in that if 10 years, 15 years ago, I had told people about something on the internet, they'd have no idea. People still to this day have no idea who Tim Berners-Lee is.
Mm-hmm. Well, including the people hosting the Olympic ceremony, the Olympic opening ceremony.
No, on NBC.
The
British Olympic organizers knew who he was. That's why he was there.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I've always said I'm just on a rant. Sorry. But the fact that when they were naming Man of the Year, Man of the Century, Time Magazine, Man of the Decade, mm-hmm. at no point was Tim Berners-Lee probably done more to change people's lives than any one individual in the last umpteen years,
mm-hmm.
he's still obscure, even though he doesn't keep himself obscure.
He's a rock star depending on where he goes, but yes. I mean, I chaired a panel with him and Vint Cerf and Al Gore in Mexico City last year, and he had at least as many screaming fans as Al Gore.
But that's the point. That's where you go.
Right.
And that's the company you keep, and those are the people that each of you,
sure.
and to a lesser extent, I am. But when I ask my listeners, when I ask my friends, I say, do you have any idea, who Tim Berners-Lee is? And then I tell them he invented the web. You know, the answer I always get. I thought that was Al Gore.
And Al Gore, to be clear, never ever said that.
Also,
the first time.
Yeah. What Al Gore did do was he coined the term information superhighway.
Well, and more significantly, what he did was held the hearings that allowed for the demilitarization of the internet and paved the way for commercial and public use.
Yes. .com became a big thing when it used to be the least used.
You know, public awareness of internet infrastructure is dismal. There was a survey announced a couple of weeks ago, admittedly by an IT company looking at touting for business, so you should take its statistics with a pinch of salt. But apparently, a really large subset of the American population, when asked about cloud computing, thought it was something to do with meteorology.
What is?
Well, I'm sure all meteorology involves a cloud somewhere, right?
I don't want to rain on your parade, but maybe not.
It's high-intensity computing, right?
After all,
it's probably not being calculated on desks. I'm sure that the National Weather Center and so on have a cloud somewhere.
I'm sure, or at least they're predicting them, if nothing else.
Right.
Since we're on technology, shifting only slightly, what's the future of publishing, he asked at Tor Books.
It's been dismal for 70 years, and the outlook is not improving. By that I mean the future of publishing is always dismal whenever you look at it. What is happening currently?
I think Charles Dickens also said something on that.
Absolutely. Yes. Again, Grub Street, 1870s.
Yeah, thank you.
What we're looking at now is a format shift. The last major format shift happened between 1990 and 1992, when the mass market for distribution of paperbacks in the United States, which were sold through wire racks in grocery wholesalers, collapsed. But authors and publishers were rescued by the rise of the big box resellers, Barnes & Noble and Borders, who would ship out large numbers of hardcovers as well, and smaller numbers of paperbacks. Everybody was running around screaming that the sky was falling in 1990, yet by 1995 everything had stabilised, and people were by and large making about the same amount of money that they'd made before. What is happening today is a new format shift, in which the mass market paperbacks are dying, The high street booksellers are in serious trouble. Borders has gone bust. Barnes & Noble isn't doing brilliantly. Retail on the high street in general is being eroded by the impact of the internet, which is very great at disintermediating supply chains and putting customers in touch with directly with suppliers, primary suppliers.
Now, with technology companies as the middleman instead of
retailers. Now, publishing, what this means is the shift to ebooks as the main mass market distribution channel. Now, some publishers are handling this well, others are handling it dismally. I tend to think that even the dismal ones will mostly survive, but they will learn better and have to eat a lot of humble pie within the next couple of years. I don't think most of them are stupid enough to stick to their guns until they go bust. The worrying thing for me is the threat of monopoly and the erosion of public rights via boneheaded insistence on digital rights management or DRM software, which is idiotic, doesn't really help the publishers. If anything, it shores up the monopoly of the large electronic distributors such as Amazon, because they hold the lock and key to who can read the ebooks, not the publishers.
It's the same thing that happened in music when Apple was putting DRM on iTunes.
Yeah, the music studios insisted on DRM until finally they realized they had given Apple a choke collar and a chain and fastened it around their own neck.
So Doctorow's first law is anytime someone puts a lock on something that belongs to you and won't give you the key, that lock is not there for your benefit. And it's just as true of music publishers whose music is locked up by Apple as it is of music fans whose music is locked up by Apple.
I will note
and
that...
And the same is true now of Amazon.
Of e-books.
I will note that most of the music on the iTunes store now may be watermarked with the email or Apple ID of the person who bought it, but it's not DRM.
So that happened once the Amazon MP3 store launched. But Apple still, you know, they control 90% of the audiobook market, and they have mandatory DRM on their audiobooks. So when Random House asked them to do DRM-free audiobooks for me with my New York Times best-selling books, they refused. They said, no, I'm sorry, we have mandatory DRM. So for all that Steve Jobs wrote that letter in which he said, oh, DRM is the evil publishers, the evil labels making us do it, they love DRM when it locks people to their platform. It's their alpha and omega.
Have you tried writing a letter to Tim Cook?
No, I guess I could.
I suggest you do. You've got enough public presence.
Of all the people.
You could also make it an open letter and CC it to The Guardian.
Yeah, yeah. So I have a slightly different version of what's happening to publishing. So first of all, I think publishing needs to be... broadly, yes. I think publishing needs to be broadly understood. And publishing, as my editor upstairs here, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, says, is the act of connecting a work with an audience. Right? It's not necessarily collecting money. It's not necessarily printing. It's not necessarily publicizing. It's some collection of activities that leads to a work and an audience meeting each other, and that is how you can explain that putting a Gideon Bible in a hotel room is publishing every bit as much as running a copy of Shakespeare is publishing, every bit as much as handing out a Hare Krishna tract on the street is publishing, every bit as much as publishing a hardcover and selling it in a bookstore is publishing.
Or posting fanfic on a fanfic website.
So I think publishing is happening more than ever. I mean, certainly, you know, Google does a very good job of connecting works and audiences. And what's really changed in my view since the 90s, since this period in which distributors for the mass market collapsed, what's really changed and really to the detriment, I think, of the kind of publishing that we do, where we write long-form novels that are exchanged for money, is that there's no longer any good way to discover that you love novels, because all of the novels are only sold in bookstores. Mm-hmm. So it used to be that, you know, you would walk in to buy some Kleenex or a box of cereal, and there would be a novel whose cover was a little poster for the book, a little advertising poster for the book, and you pick it up and you'd peruse it, and that might be the book that hooked you and turned you into a reader. And today, because we've gone from 400 distributors nationally to 3 that mostly care about the major big box retailers, Walmart and so on, and we've gone from having thousands of SKUs in the marketplace outside of bookstores to having about 100 at any given time, the likelihood that any reader will find the book that leads to her discovering that she's someone she loves novels is pretty low. And that means that we're getting fewer people sort of wandering off the street and into the church, right? We've got the biggest, bestest churches we've ever had, from Amazon to the big box retailer, book retailers like Barnes & Noble. You know, there's never been a time when it was easier to lay hands on a book. But at the same time, we don't have the Salvation Army beating the drum out on the sidewalk anymore. And so our parishioners are getting older. They're dying. And they're dwindling in numbers. And so one of the things that excites me about projects like Google Book Search is it's a means by which books can be put on an even footing with other kinds of published information as a thing that you discover serendipitously. And as a result, we may start to get new people trickling into those back pews.
Also note the huge boom in young adult fiction mm-hmm. that kicked off with the Harry Potter books and is still continuing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really, really healthy. And
I agree.
I wish I was able to do young adult.
It's fun to write.
And you can, and for that matter, a lot of what you write could be just remarketed that way.
Like Saturn's Children.
Sex, seeds and all.
Well, maybe not, but certainly there are so many books out there that I have read, and short stories by you, Charles, and a lot of stuff by Corey, and Magical Kingdom, certainly.
Down Another Magic Kingdom, yeah.
Yeah, it could simply be put out again with the word YA on the spine, and or YASF, or however you want to do it. Mm-hmm. And it would be a new market. Totally valid.
Yeah, I mean, Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game is published in two different sets of livery, as an adult book and as a kid's book. Some of the Terry Pratchett books are published that way, too.
Yeah, yeah. And some of the Pratchetts, he actually devises as YA. And you know what? I love his YA as much or more than the traditional Discworld.
Yeah, you know, young adult fiction is not fiction that can only be enjoyed by young adults. It's fiction that is that can be enjoyed by adults and young adults alike.
Absolutely. I should also add, I've got some misgivings about the market segmentation implied by classifying stuff as young adult. Okay, admittedly, I was a bit of a young book nerd. I bought my own copy of Lord of the Rings when I was 9, mm-hmm. out of my pocket money. I'd already read it. I wanted my own copy, damn it.
Oh, but real book nerds buy the Silmarillion out of their pocket money.
Yeah, I didn't. Was really disappointed.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was reading books that would frequently be classified as adults from quite an early age, and I've got a feeling that if we insist that young adults read only young adult fiction,
mm-hmm. Then we're limiting.
That we're limiting them.
Well, and vice
having
versa.
Having said that, running across J.G. Ballard's Crash when I was 12, well, I knew enough to realize fairly early on this wasn't my sort of thing and to take it back to the library.
Well, Patrick, my editor upstairs here, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, is one of the most powerful people in science fiction publishing, the head of the science fiction line at the largest science fiction publisher in the world, bought his first science fiction novel at a pharmacy in suburban Phoenix in the 1970s, and it was Dahlgren by Samuel Delaney.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely, yeah, and I should point out that when I started at WBAI in, God help me, 1967, I was reporting to Samuel R. Delaney there, and he was working on a radio drama of The Star Pit.
Right.
And it was over my head, but that didn't matter because I reached up for it. And it's, you know, it was another step on the ladder to take. Whenever I found something that was just a little bit higher for me, no matter how adult it might be, even if it's, I don't know, Nabokov or whatever it may be, I learned. And what is young adult fiction? You're right. It's limiting, and yet, on the other hand, it's saying,
I'm accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
So the other thing I want to say...
Maybe that's it. I'm accessible fiction.
Yeah, sure. Well, and also fiction that can be brought into schools without getting a librarian fired. Right? That's the other piece. School
well,
librarian.
Now...
In Kansas, that could be anything.
Yeah, where it comes to actually pandering to parents' censorious urges, I'm sorry, I don't want to go there.
Yeah.
So, I wanted to say one more thing about the future of publishing, is that... publishing, like the music industry, went through this round of severe mergers and acquisitions in the 80s and 90s that left only a few companies standing. And those companies are now are mostly publicly listed companies or, you know, giant family businesses. And they each division is charged with returning a very high rate of return on investment. Those rates of return are largely attained by eliminating permanent staff and using a kind of cloud of freelancers, many of whom used to be permanent staff and now work on a contract basis. So they don't represent a capital cost, or they're only a part of the cost of a book. So they don't cost the company anything when there's no book in production. And what that means is that what used to be a huge competitive advantage for publishing, which was that all of the expertise was held under one roof, and if you wanted a book that was copy edited, typeset, designed, and publicized by the best in the business, there was only one firm that could do it. Now all that talent is floating free on the market, and I think that we will increasingly see a delamination of the tasks that publishers perform. You know, there is no reason. You know, that it wasn't written on two stone tablets that all of those tasks need to be provided by one firm. There's no reason that you couldn't find a firm that, for example, only worked with people who already had their own publicists or their own publicity machines because they were celebrities of some kind, and for a larger chunk of the book would arrange for distribution and sales, but not publicity. Editing, distribution, and sales, but not publicity. And that company would work with all of the same people who do editing, distribution, and sales for the Big Six, but they would be hiring them on a freelance basis and leaving the publicists out and coordinating with the author's own publicity machine.
Yeah, we just
or
have
vice
to tell
versa.
People that the Big Six refer to them, the largest publishers.
The Big
standing.
Six publishers, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's Big Five studios, Big Four record labels, Big Six publishers.
Exactly, yeah. We have about 15 minutes left, so I wanted to turn a corner here and go back to some literary questions. Mm-hmm. Rapture of the Nerds is just a romp. It's funny. And we have to mention again every so often that we are here in the offices of Tor Books, thank you, who recently published The Rapture of the Nerds, where Cory Doctorow and Charles Stross is who you are listening to. And it's a romp. It's a hilarious, fun book. There was another hilarious, fun book that has actually made a splash recently, and it's just as geeky, and that is Red Shirts by John Scalzi.
Mm-hmm.
And these two books say something to me that has been missing from science fiction and speculative fiction for a long time. They're funny.
Hmm.
They're comedy. I go to the movies, and with the Avengers being a standout, and that's just because it's Whedon, everything is so bleeping grim. I am sick and tired of the angst in books, graphic novels, and cinema, and I've been Doctor Who notwithstanding. Where's the comedy?
I think to some extent it's a side effect. Writers are ordinary people too. They're affected by the world around them. We've just been going through the biggest economic depression since the 1930s. They don't call them depressions for nothing. People are literally depressed and downbeat.
And so before that, by the way, it was post-Bush.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, what you're saying works with the sirens in the background, so keep going.
So it's a real downer for the writers, and they reflect this in what they're churning out. There's a lot of that about. Also, two wars, neither of which can be declared victory, plausibly.
Mm-hmm.
That's no good either. Basically, people on this continent, at least, are depressed. Chronically low-level depressed for the past decade. Now, we're not on this continent. Corey lives in London, I live in Edinburgh in Scotland. We have our own sources of angst, but not on the same level, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I believe humour is a very important way of helping us query the envelope of our actual day-to-day environment. The real world is whimsical, strange, and full of stuff that you could not put in a work of fiction. For example, there was a news report just the other week. You know the brides are into the whole trash for dress thing, where they have a photo shoot where they destroy the elaborate wedding dress after the wedding and photograph it. Woman is doing one of these. She is drowned by the weight of her wedding dress as she's in a river.
God.
It pulls her under.
Oh, Jesus.
You could not make that up as black humor.
Right. Yeah, I think the other thing that's happened is we have swung through a neoliberal era in which the social consensus has been that people are motivated primarily by selfishness, and by and that at most that their fellow feeling extends to their neighbors and or to their family, but not to anyone else. And so, you know, we have books that are beautifully written, but frightfully evil in their outlook, like The Road, that posits that as soon as society collapses, the first thing that people do is start either raping or eating all their neighbors, or possibly both. And so I think that that reflects this shift in social consensus, this idea that you can't trust your neighbors, that everything is different now, anyone might be a terrorist, and if they're not a terrorist, they're a pedophile, the world is a scary and dangerous place. I mean, it's not, right? All the crime stats are improving year on year. Terrorism really is not a problem, right? Terrorism fatalities are down year on year, even including 9/11 over the long term since the 1960s.
I have a hypothesis to address this, which I was talking to Corey about yesterday, which is news media. We live in a media-saturated world, and the whole point of news media is to sell eyeballs to advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do this is to get people to tune into the news media, and downer news of really bad events. Something deep in the primate brain makes us look at the corpse of our neighbour as we walk past.
Mm-hmm.
Unpleasant news is much, much more attractive to people than happy, fun, human interest, kitten rescued from tree stories. Much as we like to see kittens rescued from trees, it doesn't have the same obsessive quality as a major disaster somewhere.
And yet in Minneapolis last week, they sold over 10,000 tickets to a screening of cat videos of YouTube.
Ha, ha.
Excellent.
Well, you know, I don't know if you saw, Michael Masnick, a tech dirt, wrote this great thing called The Sky is Rising. Michael Masnick, a tech dirt, wrote this thing called The Sky is Rising, and it's a report on the state of the entertainment industry. And judging from what we hear about the entertainment industry, there's never been a worse time to be in the entertainment industry. But considered as a whole, right, when you consider not just the recording industry, but the live performance industry, revenues are up. When you consider not just traditional publishers, but non-traditional and independent publishers, revenues are up. There's more people doing more business in more ways than ever before. But our focus is on the stuff that's not working, not on the stuff that is. The stuff that is considered an outlier or unimportant because it's not the mainstream. That's the only thing that's legitimate.
Yeah, sorry, my ringtone.
Mm-hmm. Is the
which
wolf.
Howled at, yeah, it's Wolf. And ironically, a former editor at Tor, John Ordover. So.
Oh, right.
So I hung up on him. Anyway, anybody knows.
I thought that was him howling. I was like, gosh, I've never heard Ordover howl.
I think he's doing that now.
Right.
But, I'm sorry. So I lost the last track of what you were saying, Corey.
Me too.
Oh, okay, fine. So
sleep deprivation.
My point is simply, the way the media functions, there's been an arms race to attract eyeballs to adverts that has resulted in putting us in an environment saturated with news of doom and despair that makes us think the world is going to hell in a handbasket around us. Whereas in reality, it isn't. In many respects, things are actually pretty good. There are problems with the world, undeniable and big problems, but it's not as bad as most of us think.
Mm. Yeah, I actually agree with that. And yet, it's just this trope that everything has to be so dark. I noticed that on the long form. I turn on the TV. I watch. I love George Martin's writing, okay? But I started reading Game of Thrones, and it is so filled with gore. And I know that it's, you know, we're simply doing The War of the Roses or The Hollow Crown, really, on the Shakespearean level with the Lancreys and all that. But there don't need to be the pulsating veins and the oral sex and all of which is on screen in there. And there is relatively little humor in this, even though it may be in what George wrote. I'll be very interested to see what Neil Gaiman does, or what they do to Neil Gaiman as HBO produces American Gods. It's going to be very interesting.
Television and cinema are difficult with humor Because jokes don't come across to every member of a committee, and what the committee doesn't approve of tends to get filtered out if the budget is big enough to have a committee overseeing how every $1 million here or there is spent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's all that gore.
Yeah, the low-budget productions are the ones where you're allowed to have humour.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, look at Clerks, right? I mean, maybe the gold standard for the kind of comedy risks you can take when you're working in a low budget environment.
Or Galaxy Quest, which was a concept humor movie made on a limited budget by Hollywood standards.
And a very, very low budget film that I love that nobody heard of, good science fiction film called Cold Souls, starring Paul Giamatti. I highly recommend it.
Oh, wow. Go seek it out. Thank you.
Yo, absolutely seek it out. It's not on Netflix anymore, but let me know and I'll find a way.
We don't have Netflix in the UK.
Amazon.
Right.
Amazon's doing that now. Right. They're, but at any rate, Cold Souls, starring Paul Giamatti, filmed in Brooklyn.
Wow, cool.
And I won't go into the whole thing now, just... let me recommend it. And it's funny, it's human, it's great science fiction, but nobody heard of it enough to get it a long list for a Hugo or a Nebula.
Right,
very
right.
Disappointing. Because it got no distribution whatsoever.
Right.
None.
Right.
Got great reviews.
But no distribution.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Nobody issued it and it's out of print now.
Right.
So maybe not the DVD, but it's not on streaming. At
right.
any rate... because you guys have gone from Google and you're heading for the New York Times next.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're slumming. There's just so much to say and I'm sort of in cognitive overload to even ask a good question. This shows my media.
We've overloaded our interviewer.
Oh.
High five.
There you go. There you go. Oh, okay, yes, I have a good one. Because we were talking about movies and all this. What of your works? I mean, I cannot imagine, given the popularity, the depth, the storylines, the humor, the angst, the future-seeking stuff. Pardon me. When is Revenge of the Nerds going to be made into a movie? Jeez. Robert Carradine just jumped into my head for a second there. When are your works going to be turned into films? Both of you write filmable stuff.
There was an option kicking around for my laundry novels, but when they came back to us for renewal after 3 years and said, we'll have a script in another 3 months, we pulled it.
Yeah.
I was involved in a sort of Skunk Works project with the BBC as well for a while, but... the director, which would be a producer in Hollywood terms, had to pull out due to other commitments, so I can probably talk about it now, but it's dead in the water. We were working on a complete reboot of a 1970s BBC science fiction series, Doomwatch.
I don't know that one.
Doomwatch was very, very popular in the early 70s, ran for about 2 seasons before a falling out between the scriptwriters and the producers killed it. It was about a government department for protecting us from scientific and technological threats... such as nuclear terrorism, genetically engineered intelligent rats, a bioengineered organism designed to digest plastic that gets loose on an airliner, this sort of thing. The sort of stuff you read about in New Scientist every week these days. But back in the early 1970s, it was scary and new and science fictional.
I sold the option to Little Brother to one of the producers from Transformers. He just renewed it, and I think he's very earnest about making it, but of course... most of the projects begun in televisual and film worlds never get completed. This is one of the reasons I've never really written screenplays, is that I can't bear the thought of working my guts out on something for years and years and then just having it buried and never ever turned into anything that anyone ever gets to see. You know, I really resent the...
or it gets turned into a travesty of your original intent.
Well, there's right. that too, but I really resent the fact that some of my favorite writers... I resent is a strong word, but I lament the fact that some of my favorite writers, the reason that we don't get much novel output from them is they're writing unproduced after unproduced screenplay.
Yeah.
It's what a pity. What a loss for all of us that you know, they're being paid to sit in the court of the Sun King and paint moles on the faces of delicate ladies in the court and never produce material for all of us to see.
Let me ask you a Barbara Walters type question. If you were a tree, if you lived in a fantasy universe where you could just, there's the movie of your creation, no intermediary, and you could make it happen with the dream team you wanted, which work of yours, or would it be an original work, would it be?
You know, I don't know anything about making movies, so I don't. I mean, I don't flatter
myself. Or media, theater is good.
I don't know anything about create. The only stuff I write is novels and stories, and a little bit of comics.
Except that you do audio.
I do.
You do audio, fact, and as a radio producer, I say, radio drama. Damn it, audio drama.
Fair enough. I mean, but my point is that I'm not a cinematic visionary, right? I don't actually know. I'm willing to stipulate that someone who is very good at what they do could turn any of my works, or really anything, into something great. There have been so many bad works turned into great movies, and vice versa, that I'm sure that it could happen.
Charles?
I'm not sure what work of mine would work well cinematically. I do tend towards too much on the high concept, too much on the introspection. It has been said with some justification that the natural prose length that is equivalent to a 2-hour long feature movie is actually the novella.
Mm-hmm.
Now, novella is something I'm reasonably strong at. I have 2 Hugos for novellas, but...
And we haven't even talked about my favorite question, which always angers Datlow every time I asked it when I was working for her at Omni, mm-hmm. which is the difference between short stories and novels, but...
Yeah. But to continue where I left off,
sorry.
I don't have that many novellas, and, you know, as with Corey, I write novels and short fiction. I don't write screenplays, poetry, or random whatever other formats. It's what I do. If I wanted to be in media, TV, film, whatever, I would be writing scripts.
It's not dead air, it's just sort of flailing around. This is WBAI, a New York City listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, and you were listening. I'm sorry, I was sitting in the newsroom talking with Sydney, which is, you know, a favorite, you know, pastime, one of the best things one can do. And the interview ends very abruptly, as you can tell. There were things that went beyond that, but weren't relevant to our broadcast this time out. There will be something of interest in the future. At any rate, that was Cory Doctorow with the North American accent, although he lives in London, and Charles Strauss, the Scot. And the name of their new novel is The Rapture of the Nerds, out from Tor Books. And look them up on Wikipedia, both of them. Strauss's short story, Lobsters, is just amazing. Corey has done a lot for the world in his pursuits through the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And yes, some of his fiction, including Down and Out in the Magical Kingdom, which I think you can download from his website under Creative Commons, which is to say it's initially free, but then the idea is, well, you know, if you like it, you ought to pay for it. His website, by the way, is Craphound, Craphound. And yes, I did figure out, first time I heard it, where he got that from. He got that from a movie called Local Hero, directed by Bill Forsyth. Wonderful movie. Late Burt Lancaster. He's not the lead, but he's wonderful in it. In his later years, he was doing a few cameos, and that was one of them. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI, New York City. Listener sponsor, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and over ourwolf.org. And we have, about 20 minutes left, including outro. And I'm willing to solicit phone calls at this time, for particularly in relation to the discussion with Corey and Charlie that you were just hearing. Obviously, I cannot speak for them, but I am no programmer, but I am also interested in many of the issues that they are. The telephone number here at BAI is 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. And in general, we're willing to talk about things of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. But, of course, I am particularly interested in comments about what you've heard over the last hour. I've been looking at the Twitter feed during the last hour as well. It was remarkably active. Although I did forget to do one thing that I often like to do when I'm in here, is see how many people are actually listening on the internet. It's very difficult to figure out feeds from the numbers from the radio. Nobody's numbers, Arbitron or anything like that, are truly accurate, and very often some of our broadcasts fall within the margin of error. But we can tell who's listening to the different feeds that are online. One call is coming into talk, and I always want to get two or three so that when one is over, we can head for the next. Otherwise, I will just chat on an issue of my own devising, or even gasp, play music. But again, the number here is 212-209-2900. And there were a few things, obviously, if you were listening, that I was taking not exactly exception with Corey, particularly about certain things. But my God, I have got to tell you, when you want to talk about a professional speaker, there was one point. This was very lightly edited, I should mention. And there was one point during the interview that Corey was talking, and there was a siren noise outside, and he just paused, and he paused, and he said, "I'll pick that up in a moment." And the moment that the exterior sound, since we were recording this at Tor Books, we weren't in a soundproof environment, the moment that went away, he went back, I swear, 10 seconds, starting with what in essence would be a paragraph, and word for word duplicated it. It was almost worth broadcasting that, just so you can see this is a professional speaker. This is a person who, especially when he was the EFF, knows how to be a spokesperson, knows how to conduct himself in an interview. It was very amusing, and something. Charlie is, I would say, a little more extemporaneous. Well, they're both extemporaneous. It's just hard to tell which is which. But it was a fascinating discussion, and I want to thank Corey and Charlie for taking time off. Next week on this program, I'm not absolutely certain what will be here, but the great likelihood is an overdue interview, another one of the ones that I recorded at the Nebula Awards weekend last May, and this would be with Mary Robinette Kowal, who's also going to be here live in December. So, I really ought to get this on the air before she comes here live, don't you think? And it was I did tons of interviews during the Nebula weekend, and this was one of the more interesting and more entertaining. Not that the ones with, for example, Connie Willis and some of the other people were dull exactly, or the John Kessel one. I'm pretty proud of the broadcasts that we've had the last few weeks. Okay, let's give it a try again, 212-209-2900. Good morning, you're on the air. Hi there, how are you?
Am I on the air?
You are. Turn down your radio, we're on delay.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, I'm Rebecca.
Hi, Rebecca.
The person you interviewed was named Cory Doctorow. Is there any chance that that person is related to an E.L. Doctorow that wrote a book entitled Ragtime?
I asked him that some years ago, and he first said no, and he then said it's possible there is some connection, but if so, it's distant.
Oh, okay.
But they are spelled the same way.
So it's not necessarily a literary family.
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
But I haven't encountered the name of a Doctorow yet that I've read that I didn't like.
Oh, okay. Well, that was my question.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, I'm enjoying the show. Continue.
Thanks. Okay, have good a good morning. Take care. And good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I totally agree with you that we have much too much dark, gloom, doom, whatever, which is why, as I said to a friend of mine, the perfect antidote is to read books by Michael Chabon, however he pronounces it.
Although his latest book, which just came out, is a bit dark.
Oh, yes. Well, I think you're talking about the
Telegraph Hill.
Yeah. I didn't like the summary of it. It just sounded a little bit...
Well, that's the point.
Yes. However...
I mean, I love his writing. Oh, I like his screenplays, but that may not be the book for me.
Oh, well, I have to say, if I were going to recommend two right away, and right now I'm in the midst of reading The Gentleman of the Road and, of course, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, those would be the two.
Yeah.
And the
and don't forget The Wonder Boys.
Oh, The Wonder Boys.
And his screenplay, of course, for John Carter of Mars.
Okay, and of course, The Adventures of Cavalier. And
right,
play. Yes.
Absolutely. His short stories are wonderful.
Yes, I wonder if he's collected them in an anthology or not.
There have been several collections, not anthologies. Anthologies are multiple writers.
I'm very curious. Oh, yeah, well, he has the thrilling McSweeney thing.
Oh, he has many anthologies. Yeah. He has edited any number of anthologies, but you were referring to a collection of his stories.
Yes. And I would also, by the way, you had a discussion with Michael Bishop a couple of weeks ago on baseball, and I would include his Summerland in that, of things on baseball.
One I don't know.
It starts out as a... two baseball teams being formed in the Pacific Northwest and winds up in a baseball game to outdo all baseball games for nothing less than control of the universe.
That's minor compared to the Iowa Baseball Confederacy by W.P. Kinsella.
Tell me about that one.
Well, it's hard to summarize, and it's been too long since I've read it, but it's Kinsella.
Okay.
Kinsella is mystical and wonderful and Canadian. It's great stuff.
Now, the other thing that you mentioned, something that I had heard a few weeks ago from a friend, that HBO has optioned. I'm very curious to see what they do with American Gods.
They haven't optioned it. It's made.
Oh, it's made?
Yes. I mean, they're in the middle of filming. This is going on, yeah. This is coming up soon, yes.
They're doing 6 seasons at least? This is what I've heard.
No.
No, not 6?
No. No. You do a year at a time. They haven't even optioned 3 years on Game of Thrones. They're just doing the third year, and that's huge. So no, it doesn't work like that.
So what?
An option is nothing but a reservation. That's all an option is. We're going to give you this money to hold on to it. After that, then there's usually I'm forgetting the word, but a premise of how the screenplay is going to be done. Then there's a screenplay. But they have been filming American Gods, from what I understand. I don't know the casting. It probably can be looked up. But, I mean, this is what follows Game of Thrones, which is going to be finishing up its third season right now. But that's going to go, you're probably confusing the two weeks. Game of Thrones has a total of 7 books, 5 of which are out, and each book represents a season as it progresses.
Well, that's the way it works with a series. Each book would represent a season?
Well, that's how HBO has been doing it.
I see.
And American Gods, isn't an open series. It's a novel.
No, it is. Okay, well, something to look forward to anyway. Noah Gaiman.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how they handle it. They could ruin it.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, you have to, you know, now they've done a very good job with Game of Thrones, but since I don't care to watch gore, I don't watch it.
Well, I haven't read any of the books. I didn't realize it was that gore.
It is.
That much gore.
It is.
Too many body counts, huh?
It's not just a question of body count. Body count.
Yes. No,
we're
no.
talking about descriptions of arterial,
yes.
What's the word? When spouting, arterial spouting. We're talking about, you know, severed limbs, descriptions in loving detail of decapitations and torture, arrows and spears through eyes, watching the eye burst open as it is pierced. That's gore, okay? That's what I'm talking about.
Sounds like a Sam Peckinpah movie.
No.
No.
Well, Sam Peckinpah is mild. Sam Peckinpah is 40 years ago.
Well, Wild Bunch was pretty horrific.
No, it's not in the same class.
Okay. All right.
All righty.
See you the 27th.
Okay. And I'm afraid we lost some of our other calls, but we only have about 4 minutes left. But if you still care to call up and comment, the telephone number here is 212-209-2900. Be sure to stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming up. And, I didn't press that right. Good morning, you're on the air. Nope. Now, that time I pressed it right, but the person unpressed it. Hi there, you're on the air. Hello?
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. How are things in Bulgaria?
Well, I enjoyed the interview with Cory Doctorow and Shirley Strauss, and it's interesting. Over the past year, I've had the privilege of meeting both of them at various events.
They do travel.
Well, yeah. Mr. Strauss was a guest of honor at Eurocon in Zagreb.
So he mentioned, yes.
Yep. And in December, both Cory Doctorow and I were at Congress in Berlin.
Wow.
And thanks for a good interview, and I'm looking forward to their new book.
It's a fun book. It's a mind bleep.
So I've heard. Well, have a great morning.
Okay, you
thank
too.
You for another great show. It's been a great run of great shows you've been doing recently.
Yeah, I've been lucky with the run of the last few, haven't I?
More than a few, I'd say.
No, thanks a lot. Okay, take care now.
Have a great morning.
You too. And time for one more. Good morning, you're on the air. Hi, turn down your radio, please.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I'm sorry, it's very hard to hear you.
Okay, well, perhaps if you...
I can hear you now.
Okay, very good.
I love Game of Thrones, and it's really upsetting when they just spring the decapitation on you,
mm-hmm.
but it's so worthwhile. I just enjoyed it so much, just for the storytelling.
Well, the storytelling is spectacular. You know, George Martin is a favorite writer of mine.
Right.
But...
It's good that they actually give some explanations at the end, because it's just very confusing, too. I guess it's a lot to put into a little miniseries.
Yeah. It covers this vast, vast scope, and they do a very good job. But there came a point... about two-thirds of the way in the first season, before they killed off Sean Bean, where there was that scene, you know, where we have to watch the spear piercing somebody's eye. And you know what? I'm having nightmares of that.
Okay.
If you go to sleep and those images stay with you and you feel uncomfortable and you wake up in a cold sweat, then the answer is that is not for you.
Yeah.
And for many people, it's fine. It's great. I'm in the minority, but
I think you missed out. But they don't warn you beforehand. They actually did something to a horse that I screamed, and my cat like jumped 6 feet you know, and they don't tell you until it happens. So, but I didn't read it. I only watched the show, and I guess I'm you know, missing out on the writing.
Yeah, well, no, the writing is superb, of course. They actually, you know, they're actually respecting George's work and doing, you know, a fine job with it, and I'm very pleased. But hey, I'd like them to see A Song of Stars and Shadows or some of his science fiction. There was a George Martin movie made, and it turned out to be a bit of a gore fest at the end. It wasn't a very good movie, but it was fun.
I think that's necessary these days in order to keep people, I don't know, it's, you know?
Unfortunately, in my case, it actually keeps me away.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, and I'm not passing judgment, I'm just saying it's not for me.
Right. Yeah, all right. I just, you know, I do enjoy it even in spite of it. But, you know.
No, I recognize
that.
Each
to his own, right?
I'm sorry?
Each to his own.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one does worry. I'm trying to remember. Oh, yeah. I mean, at the time that the massacre of the Dark Knight Rises occurred, a few Hollywood producers did say, take a look at the intensity of that movie. Take a look at the stuff that Christopher Nolan has so successfully and so skillfully brought into people's heads, and tell me that this doesn't, in fact, help certain people get rid of inhibitions they have about violence. Not saying causes violence, but it does inure people to it.
Funny how you, when you think of the Godfather movie, you always think of the head in the bed.
Exactly.
There it is.
Exactly. We're out of time, but thank you so much for calling.
Really a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too. Good night. And thank you. Oh, whoop, I'm bringing up the music too quickly. Thank you all for listening. And, of course, thanks to Cory Doctorow and Charlie Strauss. Again, the name of the book is The Rapture of the Nerds. Next week, unless something particular happens to change it, my guest will be on recording, Mary Robin at Kowal, and I hope that you are here for that. Until then, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and visit me online at ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or on Facebook on the Hour of the Wolf group within Facebook itself. In the meantime, enjoy your week, enjoy the weather, and take care. Put on hold the bowl, lose control, so they force a
piece of cloth. That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but no black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
Thank you. 99 Cinque Lista back from North Carolina, NC, Robert Knight. Had a good time on the beach of Oka Croak Island. Got busted on the beach. Yo, talk to me. Damn. But it was fun. 99 Cinque, Burn Baby Burn Lista here. Yeah, I got busted. Robert Knight, $175. Damn! Busted on the beach of Ocracoke Island, y'all. Nothing to declare. Yeah, a Ku Klux Klan P.I.G. busted Mr. on the beach of Ocracoke. That's exactly what I asked the pig. How did you find out? Was it that guy on the beach says this, this in the nude running on the beach? I was in the water up to my neck. I wonder. How could he know that I was? You know? Robert Knight helped me. How did they find out? 99 Cinque Lista live right on the radio back here. Thank you, Ahmed Ali, for sitting right here at Burn Baby Burn, where we burn the imperialist flag to ashes, y'all.